You can pronounce it warmer if you want to, or you can go, hi there, good morning, just pick up a hand up. You can also try the Brazilian Portuguese pronunciation, which is the Burga. And yesterday I learned this beautiful French pronunciation, French is like Vanda. So you can try whichever. I answer to all of the above. I'm a professor at the Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. I'm originally from Brazil. And I was asked to talk about the theology of the cross. One of the things that I teach is Lutheran theology. I am also a Lutheran pastor. Currently, I'm serving as a member of the joint Lutheran Roman Catholic bilateral dialogue, the international level, the one that is, please pick up a hand up and join us. It's part of the Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue that culminated with the signing of the Joint Declaration on Justification in 1989. And this phase of our dialogue now is dealing with baptism. And in 2017, as those of you who are familiar with the Lutheran tradition, we are going to celebrate the 500 years of the Reformation, to the signing of Martin Luther's, the posting of the 95 theses at the Castle Church in Wittenberg. So we are working on having a joint declaration on the Reformation, which is a major, major endeavor. So I'm leaving here and going to two meetings, and one of them is this time in Finland, and we are going to see how we can actually come to an agreement about what actually happened in 1517. Even what is going to happen, even the title of this document, the Lutherans were very much into celebrating Reformation, and our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters say, no, I think it's more like mourning, celebration. And so I think we are going to settle with commemorating it, which is like bring to memory, and then commemoration has this joyous aspect, but also a little bit of, you know, it's sad that it had to happen, but it happened after all. So just to give you a little bit of my background and how I actually see Lutheran theology applying these days. I teach all courses related to Lutheran history and tradition and Lutheranism at Luther College. I used to do that back at the Lutheran Seminary in Brazil. I was for many years a professor of systematic theology. I was also the vice president of the seminary, and then more recently I was also dean of graduate studies. In the bios, people ask us not to put any of these academic things because that just turns people off. And I understand that. It's like, oh, who wants to go to that session? Anyway, I have a handout for you because, as you notice, I do speak with an accent. And I'm always concerned that people will not get what I mean to say, because I speak very passionately, and the more passionately I speak, the faster I speak, and that becomes very difficult, and sometimes acoustic doesn't help either. So I always have a handout so that people can remember what it is that we talk. This is not all we're going to talk. I would like also to draw on your own experiences, your own expertise. If you came, it's because theology of the cross is something that intrigues you, something that uplifts you, something that you live by, and something that is really meaningful to you. And so I want to honor that, because I want to also create an opportunity for you to share what a theology of the cross is for you. So my idea is, let's start with the origins in just the coining of a theologian of the cross or a theology of the cross. Move on with that, and then also allow for some opportunity to hear from your own input. So the term theology of the cross, the term itself, is seldom used by Martin Luther. He did, however, coin the expression a theologian of the cross. And because I think it really has to do with the fact that for Martin Luther, theology never was anything abstract that you do in writings. Like nowadays we have a theology, a process theology, a liberation theology, a feminist theology, an Indian theology, an African theology, a Latin American theology. We have so many theologies. For Martin Luther, that never was a reality that we would have a field of knowledge called theology. But it was something that you were supposed to live. Hence, a theologian of the cross, because this is something that you not only think, but you also feel and you also live. And a theologian of the cross is what he then addresses in his writings. And the key of this, what we nowadays come to call a theology of the cross, is the following. That only the cross can tell us who God is and how God saves. And that is such an important event, such an important a moment, such an important experience, that it becomes symptomatic for all of Luther's writing. There's a handout here going to Ben over there. And this came into light very early in Martin Luther's career. Already in, as I said, in 1517, he was nailing the 95 Theses at the door at the castle church in Wittenberg. And in 1517, very true to the scholastic mode in which education was carried out in medieval times, there were these disputes, there were these debates. And also, as it happened with the 95 Theses, a professor or somebody who was presenting a point of an argument would then either post those theses or would have them handed out. And usually they were not 95, so that's, you know, usually what people agree on. They would usually be between 15 and 30 theses. About a certain topic. And in 1518, Luther was invited to participate in the Heidelberg disputation. And so he develops these 28 theses to try to spell out what this theologian of the cross in, would be and how that would relate to some of the core ideas that Luther was developing at the same time. Needless to say, can you just pick up also a handout and join me around here? I've never bitten anybody. I promise. And so I thought you would enjoy being able to read these 28 theses and also the short preface that comes to it. I put you, I indicate where it comes from. It comes from Luther's works, volume 31. Pages 39 to 41. So what I would like us to do is to read the preface, start with the second paragraph here, and if we could just take turns reading the pieces as they are. I'll start by reading just the introduction to it. Distrusting completely our own wisdom, according to that counsel of the Holy Spirit, do not rely on your own insight, Proverbs 3:5. We humbly present to the judgment of all those who wish to be here these theological paradoxes, so that it may become clear whether they have been deduced well or poorly from St. Paul, the specially chosen vessel and instrument of Christ, and also from St. Augustine, his most trustworthy interpreter.
Man crucified.
Yes, this is the official translation that we have in Luther's work, and I just copied it. I apologize tremendously for the androcentric language. Still, instead of translating the German Mensch as human being, it translates it as man, you know, which I think it's probably something that should be revised very quickly. So please, yes, make it inclusive.
The law of God, the most salutary doctrine of life, cannot advance people on their way to righteousness, but rather hinders them.
Much less can human works, which are done over and over again with the aid of natural precepts, so to speak, lead to that end.
Although the works of mankind always seem attractive and good, they are nevertheless likely to be mortal sins.
Although the works of God always seem unattractive and pure evil, they are nevertheless really eternal merits.
The works of humans are thus not mortal sins. We speak of works which are apparently good, as though they were crimes.
Yes, here, there's a seed waiting right here in the room, please.
The works of God, we speak of those which he does not, which he does through mankind, are thus not merits, as though they were sins.
The works of the righteous would be mortal sins if they would not be feared as mortal sins by the righteous themselves out of pious fear of God.
By so much more are the works of humankind, of humans, mortal sins, when they are done without fear and in unadulterated evil self-security.
To say that works without Christ are dead but not mortal appears to constitute a perilous surrender of the fear of God.
Indeed, it is very difficult to see how a work can be dead and at the same time not a harmful and mortal sin.
Arrogance cannot be avoided or true hope be present unless the judgment of condemnation is feared in every work.
In the sight of God, sins are then truly venial when they are feared by humans to be mortal.
Free will after the fall exists in name only, and as long as it does what it is able to do, it commits a mortal sin.
Free will after the fall has power to do good only in a passive capacity, but it can always do evil in an active capacity.
Nor could free will endure in a state of innocence, much less do good in an active capacity, only in its passive capacity.
The person who believes that he or she can obtain grace by doing what is in him and her and sin to sin so that he becomes doubly guilty.
Nor does speaking in this manner give cause for fear, but for arousing the desire to humble oneself and seek the grace of Christ.
It is certain that humans must utterly despair of their own ability before they are prepared to receive the grace of Christ.
That person does not deserve to be called a theologian, who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened. Romans 1:20.
He or she deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering on the cross.
A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is.
That wisdom which sees the invisible things of God in works as perceived by people is completely puffed up, blinded, and hardened.
The law that brings the wrath of God kills, reviles, accuses, judges, and condemns everything that is not in Christ.
Yet that wisdom is not of itself evil, nor is the law to be evaded. But without a theology of the cross, people misuse the best in the worst manner.
He or she is not righteous who does much, but he or she who, without work, believes much in Christ.
The law says, do this, and it is done. Grace says, believe in this, and everything is already done.
Actually, one should call the work of Christ an acting work, and our work an accomplished work, and thus an accomplished work pleasing to God by the grace of the acting work.
The love of God does not find, but creates, that which is pleasing to it.
the love of humans comes into being through that which is pleasing to it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your creative thoughts. This is very important. Thanks. This is community at its best. One of the things that caught your attention as you were listening or as you were reading, what would you like to highlight? How do you think these theses are taken as, you know, starting point when we talk about the theology of the cross? What did you like about it? What did you not like about it?
Gotta go back and find it.
Oh, yeah, okay, I'll give you a second.
I'm thinking such a person would never get elected to public office.
To public office, also in the church, do you think?
Yes, either
and
one.
And the bishop?
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. I get lost through a lot of it, but I think number 21, I really like that one. When someone calls evil good and good evil, however, theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is.
Well, this is the core of it. It really has to do with the definition of what the theologian of the cross is all about. And what comes before it really prefaces it in the sense of what role does knowledge play, what role do good works play, this is 1518 that Martin Luther is writing it. So the 95 theses were put out a year before, so a lot about the core ideas of justification by faith are undergirding this very idea, right? So the earlier, what seems to be, like, what's the confusing argument, all refers to, you know, what is so effervescent in the conversations that the students are having, that the monks are having, that the people in the congregation might be having. You know, we don't know to which extent common people had access to a lot of that, but, you know, this was happening. So, but you identified one of the key issues, yes. What else did you like?
Oh, 27. Actually, what you call the work of Christ an acting work and all work an accomplished work. It's quite a wonderful idea, thought, concept. Yes, it wouldn't be a concept if it's practical. Uh-huh. But because I think we so often say, Jesus said it is finished, that the work is accomplished. And you think of all of it as accomplished, but working, acting through the grace of Christ. It's a wonderful way of looking at it.
It also helps us understand ourselves as human beings, because one of the big tensions going on with scholasticism at Luther's time is, what are human beings capable of? And there's a lot of optimism, which Luther does not necessarily share, in terms of the good that can be brought forth by my own good intentions. And Luther would say, no, even my good intentions are tainted by selfish desires. Mm-hmm. If I do good, and as it so often happens in our days, if people do good, they want to make sure that the media is there to give it coverage, right? So that it's actually recognized publicly they're doing good. So that good, Luther was very good in understanding that human intentionality in terms of the boasting and elevating ourselves. And scholastic philosophy in Luther's day was more optimistic, saying, well, God has given us some good, and that good can be used, you know, God has given us a measure of something, and now we can work our way towards God. We can do that good, and really it is within our power. But at the end of the day, there is a distinct way of seeing human beings. Whereas in the Lutheran tradition, and not only developed in Martin Luther, but this goes, you know, the last 500 years, so to say, an awareness that human beings are always under construction, you know. We should carry the signs tonight. That we are never quite done, that God is never quite done with us. Mm-hmm. And I think this particular thesis shows that we are works in progress, and that always God is acting in us and through us, and that that measure of process, that's the dynamic aspect of faith in us that, that carries it out. I'm glad you highlighted that.
Along with the, those that have been spoken on, really was taken by 28, the love of God does not find, creates that which is pleasing to us. I think that follows what you were saying. Mm-hmm. The love of healing comes into being through that which is pleasing.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Number 19. The invisible things, is that referring to spirituality, such as trying to justify the tornado in Joplin, Missouri as an act of God or a tsunami? And you can name the theology and think it's susceptible in those things, but really we cannot use the Bible or use this as a justification of what's happened. I don't quite know what.
I think the way you are reading it would be a good way of making it, translating it into a contemporary reality and translating it to, you know, 21st century events.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure exactly what is behind it in Martin Luther's day, but always the claim that somehow people who were ordained had a deeper insight into the will of God, or that that some people can, almost like the art of divination, you know, you have a secret knowledge of something, or that you can read these events and be able to forecast that in 2012 the world will end, you know, and
it doesn't necessarily take a theologian to do that, though. Anybody can do that, seems like.
Right. Yeah.
But
I think, yeah. And in medieval days, I think because there were so many people ill-trained also as theologians, so there probably was a lot of that going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I like your interpretation much better.
Yeah. I'm looking at number 18, and this would hit me one way if I read it. In my despair, God needs me. I would hear that one way, but if I read, I must despair of my own ability before I'm to receive the grace of Christ. Mm-hmm. To me, that doesn't sound quite like good news. It sounds more like a law. So I want it to be more good news, I guess.
Right. I will anticipate something that probably would normally just say at the end of it. Because maybe Lutheran anthropology, Martin Luther's perception of human beings is more negative than positive. He is very skeptical about anything that human beings can be able to do on their own. He just reduces to sacks of worms, you know. Not a very nice picture. But in order for, at the core of this is really justification by faith. And it does have a happy ending after all. But in order for you to be able to receive grace, you really have to know what the Spirit is. The bigger the need, the bigger the present. You cannot really embrace grace if you have your hands full of other good things that are, you know, you cannot just juggle that as well. And you can only truly understand what grace is when you have felt the void from the deeps of your own existence. Then is when it really reaches you. It sounds like law, but it's not supposed to be law. It is a true acknowledgement of human condition. Mm-hmm. And the human condition is that we are broken, that we are miserable, that we all suffer, that we have needs, that we need to be constantly comforted like small babies. And you know, that's who we are as human beings. We then put this facade, we wear masks, we pretend that we are self-sufficient, that we have all these titles, that we are, you know, self-made, we can just pull ourselves up, you know, pulling our own bootstraps. And that's what Luther really comes in against Scholasticism, that our minds, our thoughts, that the way we think, that we can reason in such a way that we can reason to even understand God, that our mind is so capable that we ourselves can understand who God is. And so by having this facade, just by pretending that we are self-reliable, that we can be self-sufficient and independent, that we can just do it on your own, we fall into the greatest entrapment of sin. And that's why justification by faith then becomes the key words for understanding how it connects to a theology of the cross. A theology of the cross is only makes sense when you are honest about yourself, when you are true to yourself. And I wanted to go back and quote from the song that has been sung in Bible study every morning, which you have done, you and Mary have done so beautifully. It's when we stop, when we cease, you know, telling secrets or lies about who we are and about our own reality, and we come to grasp the fragility, the vulnerability, the own brokenness in which we find ourselves. Now, some people will say, and I think this is part of the Reformed tradition, and some people will blame it on Calvinism, and I don't do that, I think we all partake in this, that to acknowledge our sinful nature will say, well, you're just bad human beings, that you're just bad, you know. Part of that fundamentalist view that you're a sinner, you're not worth, you're not any good. That is a misreading of Luther's understanding of sin. Sin is really having broken away from God, having broken away from grace, having declared that you're independent from God and that you don't need God anymore. It's what it's hubris, it's having that pride that we do not need to be in relationships anymore, whether it be with God, with our fellow human beings, or in community. And so even an understanding of sin that comes to terms with that allows us to cherish what this theology of the cross is really about. Does that help you?
Yeah, I just wish you would have written it differently.
You know what? We can blame it on translation.
We need to retranslate.
We can go back to the Latin.
I think I'm going to put number 26 in my bathroom mirror. I found myself in a clergy conference one time honestly introducing myself and saying, I proclaim grace, but I live works righteousness. Mm. So that one's mine.
Yeah. Our culture encourages to do that because we're all put on a performance basis all of our lives. And so it's hard to remember the other way.
And this again has been a major misinterpretation of Lutheran theology to say that the Reformation was against good works. And if you would just read, and here again, you know, why it seems so confusing, those first paragraphs, it's like, good works are actually sinful. You know, that's what the first thesis are saying. He would say, well, we are not for good works. We are all for being justified by faith, and let's just rest in that hammock out there, and you know. And that's not what it's all about. It has to do with grace operating through us and the righteousness that we receive from God, a righteousness that comes from an other. It is a righteousness that is imputed through Christ. But then it translates into good works, because now that righteousness is in my relationship with my neighbor. And that then is done out of faith, not out of the demands of the law, which would be say, well, you do this because that's good work, it's the law. But the good work really stems from justification itself. It's faith acting through, it's grace acting through. And at the end of the day, instead of, if you do a good deed, don't call the media, you know? and you should say, well, it's really not me, it's God through me. Because all glory should go to God and not to our, you know, vain human attempts. And so at the end of the day, we are always instruments. We are under construction, but we're also the instruments of God's love imparted unto others. Jess, you want to say something?
I haven't heard the word yet to describe sin, but it's been sneaking around under our chairs. Original?
Original.
And Raphael in the Sunday night sermon said that was not an appropriate term, that we sin against our origin as opposed to being born in original sin. I like that.
Right. The word sin appears in the Genesis. And I know that all of you read the Bible. So the word sin appears in the Genesis narrative, not in Genesis 1 or 2, the creation narratives, or 3, which is usually titled as the fall, which, I mean, has nothing to do with sin. The word sin appears in chapter 4. And what happens in chapter 4 is when a brother kills a brother. That is when sin occurs for the first time. And that's very important. And Augustine had some major misreads of Genesis 2 and 3 and you know that a lot of the language of original sin comes from Augustine. Instead of talking about sin in this way about what is bad about human beings, if we were to talk about what is the human condition here, and the original aspect of it is that indeed we are dependent, we are created by God, that we are given a lot of potentials which we do not necessarily turn into reality. When confronted with responsibility, we blame others, and that when given an opportunity of rectifying situations, we still hide behind other people, right? That's basically what Genesis 3 is all about. I told the story differently, in a way that 21st century person could understand without having to go back to the narrative. But that's the gist of it. That's who we are. The classic example is when God is taking a hike in the garden, because this is a hike in the month, right? Right? God's taking a hike.
Been to Holden.
Yeah. Right. It comes back from a hike, and these two humans just had disappeared. God calls them. They don't answer. They talk. Then finally they appear, and they said, we were afraid. The word fear appears for the first time, because when your eyes are open, you are afraid. That's why, you know, ignorance is bliss. Because when you don't know about things, you can just pretend that everything is okay. But when your eyes are open, you start becoming afraid. But what is it that you do when your eyes are open, you are afraid, instead of being accountable? And now, let's face it, I have this knowledge. You just hide. And God says, did you eat? And the man says, he kind of like, he blames God and the woman, you know, kind of like, no, the woman that you created made me eat. So blames God and the woman. The woman doesn't fare much better, and she says, the serpent made me eat. And the serpent, I mean, this would never stand in a court, because the serpent does not have the right to defense here. Did you notice that? Any lawyer here will say, well, there was no fair trial here. Because she is just blamed and punished. So we read this narrative of saying, this is our original sin. But have we ever spelled it out? We think that because, and Augustine, because of the confessions, we think that because of everything that he wrote about human sexuality, original sin means that we are born of flesh, that our parents had sex, and that's why there is original sin. No, we are born into a reality in which whenever, if ever given a chance, we will just escape our responsibilities. We will deny that we are dependent, that we will not live up to our full human potentials. And in that sense, yes, there is an original sin, because we are born into that reality, and it's a cycle that perpetuates itself. What I like about sin against our origins is that the word sin really comes at the epitome of what it means to then break away from relationships, which is when you kill somebody. And you can say, well, as long as I don't kill, I'm not sinning. But that we have expanded that notion of what the quality of life is all about and moved away from a very legalistic perspective of description of sin to include a broader notion of, you know, it's not only not kill, but also let's assure that there is life in abundance. Yes, please.
I think that the thing that I struggle with most in this and in other things that Luther has done is the condemnation of works outside of works that, you know, I think are, we would all consider good, things that are happening in the world that are good, but outside the realm of justified through faith, justified through faith in God. And so people who are, you know, not Christian, who are not believing in any way, but are still doing good things in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's hardest for me to stomach is that Luther would say that their work's in vain.
Yes and no. Because you are totally right. Luther had severe limitations when it came to anything intercultural, interfaith, gender.
Yeah.
Right on. but he does have these glimpses. For instance, when he says that he would much rather be under the government of Turks than he would be a Christian, because Turks value education, for instance. And he would not put any value judgment on what that Turkish government was doing. That was what Luther understood, Muslims. And that he saw that as positive.
Yeah.
And yeah, he says one good thing and then he says another thing that's bad. So,
and I don't mean to put him on the defensive, nor you on the defensive, but that I guess maybe I should rephrase my question, that how do we as Lutherans who look at this and say, yes, you know, we understand that it is justification through faith that makes our works good in the world. How do we look at people outside of that and still see those works as good? Yeah. I mean, is there a phrase or a theology that you would look to?
Yeah. Then we, of course, need to move away from Luther's writings, and we need to draw on the last 500 years of Lutheran scholarship on this. The first, I would go back to the joint declaration on the doctrine of justification. One of the big issues addressed there, and which the joint declaration clearly states that Lutherans and Catholics, for instance, we cannot truly agree how these good works come out to be good, because Catholics still preach that through baptism God has given us a measure of goodness, and that as Christians we are responsible for working on that measure of goodness and carrying out justice and doing good works, because God has given us a head start through baptism. That's a Catholic view. And Lutherans would say, no, in baptism we receive that, but we also have a daily affirmation of baptism, because God every day needs to renew that. We do not have that surplus of righteousness that we can just carry, you know, and do something with it, but it's constantly in need of renewal. That's why baptism becomes such an important aspect of Lutheran theology as it is. So we have reached something called an agreement that even though we do not necessarily agree on the nitty-gritties of it, we do agree that God is working through us. Okay? And that's called, in ecumenical jargon, a differentiated consensus. Okay? We have a consensus on a difference. Right? I think it's a Solomonic, you know, decision to go and use that. We have a differentiated consensus about this. You know? We have unity and diversity, right? That would be the anthropological way of putting it. We have unity and diversity, okay? But we can affirm that mutually with Catholics. Now we are working in how to do that also in an interfaith level. How can we affirm that God is acting? Now, not the triune God, but we're talking about Allah. We are talking about Krishna, or we are talking about philosophies of life such as Buddhism. Mm-hmm. How is it that the goodness that is being carried out by believers of those traditions have a merit in and of themselves? And at the end of the day, Luther helps us here, because it's not up to us to judge. So there's good being done, praise God, you know, and also the humility that we are not the ones to carry out judgment on that, but we know in our own hearts what we do, and so we, at this point, we are responsible for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Any other observation?
Well, Wanda, one of the core teachings from it was in systematics, we were given 10 basic tenets of Lutheranism, and one was the positive creation. Mm-hmm. And so even before the discussion of sin was that we were created and we're created good. And that's what I liked about that sin is a violation against our origin, because, and that's what I loved about this, that the love of God does not find but creates that which is pleasing, creates good. And so that's how I relate to what you're saying. I mean, the Turk or the Muslim or the whomever is still God's good creation. And I know we've been in times where we have struggled deeply in a family crisis. And people not of the faith have been walking right beside us. And I see their gifts, their good gifts, as the love of God working through them. Mm-hmm. That, you know, God's good work pleasing. And rather than our trying to create this good work and be good enough, and then we can make our faith statement and become a child of God, and mm-hmm. Now we're good.
Can I ask a volunteer to just read the paragraph following the thesis?
Mm-hmm. Both of them.
Just one. Both of them.
The
The theses indicate some of Luther's key theological ideas, particularly the human inability to fulfill the law. We cannot earn righteousness. The utmost dependence on God's grace. We cannot add to or increase the righteousness of the cross. And justification by faith. Any righteousness is given to us from outside us. Extra nos. This contrasts with a theology of glory, which preaches that we have the ability to do the good works that lie within us, that there remains, after the fall, some ability to choose good, and that we can be saved by participating in or cooperating with the righteousness given by God. For the theologian of the cross, we can only know about God from God's self-revelation, through God's Word made flesh, Jesus the Christ. A theologian of the cross preaches what seems foolish to the world. In a 1519 sermon, Luther explains that there are two types of righteousness: alien, the righteousness achieved through Christ, and proper. It is proper not because we alone work it, but because we work with that first and alien righteousness. This is that manner of life spent profitably in good works, in slaying the flesh and crucifying the desires with respect to self, in love to one's neighbor, in meekness and fear toward God. In this world, let us live soberly, pertaining to crucifying one's own flesh, justly, referring to one's neighbor, and devoutly, related to God.
So, finishing with this quote from Titus, I just want to clarify that the expression, let us crucify our own flesh. People in this country are very much influenced by Puritanism, and so they think it has to do anything with bodily desires, especially sexuality. But the desires of the flesh here primarily are greed. And that deeply relates with our contemporary reality in this country, you know, in which people are so greedy in terms of the economy. It's like, yes, that calls us a Christian nation, but that number one aspect of, you know, curbing the desires of flesh, it's like control your greed, is not taken into consideration. We tend to bring the observation desires of the flesh to things that are very private and intimate, and we want to control that, but the things of, that are in front of everybody's eyes that we do not address. It's a very interesting country to be in. The theology of the cross has to do with the understanding of sin. Yes, please.
Oh, I just had a quick question about it in general. I was reading a book last week. It was about St. Francis, and they use the term theology of the cross quite a bit, but they used it in a really different context, and I was curious about that. They talked about the theology of the cross in terms of solidarity with the suffering, and the idea that Christ is in solidarity with the suffering, and that some part of Christ is still on the cross until, as long as people are suffering, and that as Christians, it's our responsibility to be in solidarity with the suffering and to work for justice.
Right.
I sort of see that reflected here, but more just humility.
That's where we are moving to.
Okay.
Thank you for making the transition. Oh, so thankful. We are a community of learning. Yes. The theology of the cross is deeply related with our understanding of what sin is. And so Luther would try to describe sin as disobedience to God's commandment, and going back to the Genesis narrative. You do not do what God asks you to do. A will to power, meaning to say, we want to be like God. And hubris, meaning to say, I can do on my own, and I can be self-sufficient. I don't need to rely on God. Now, we have learned a lot in the 20th century from contextual theologies, from liberation theology, feminist theologies, African theologies, which reminded us that the notion of sin is not only will to power, but but it's also not stepping up to one's own potentiality, to the agency, to that capacity that we have. And that has always been very present in our liturgy. If you remember Sunday morning, we confess the sins that we have done, you know, the wrong that we have done, but also the good that we have left undone. And our theology has focused primarily on the wrong that we have done, but not so much on the good that we have left undone. And the good that is left undone speaks very, very closely to people who find themselves disempowered or disenfranchised in society. People who think that, who have interjected the notion that they are worthless, that there is no value in their own existences, that their very lives are reduced to garbage. If you have heard anything from the people from Haiti, some of their personal stories really reflect that. And as a friend of mine called Ivone Javada summarizes it, there are people whose existence is translated by negativity. You have no sense, you have no knowledge, you have no being, you have no no job, you have no property. So if everything in your life is no, you are also no person. And what that has to do, we say, well, the people who are living in this condition, aren't they the saints of the earth already? Because they have embodied that self-emptying of the cross, that they are the ones who are the sufferers of the world. They are the ones who are hanging on the Christ, on the cross with Christ at this point. And many scholars, many liberation theologians, and many people who work very closely to people who are living in this dire situation, they say, no, it's just because you are living in suffering does not mean that you are necessarily without a need of transformation in and of yourself. That capacity, that resilience that we have in ourselves as human beings, which is part of the creativity that we partake from God, the Creator, which allows us to move beyond the negativity into something that is transformative, and that as human beings, we are also asked to come to terms with that reality that is within each of us, but then also to reach out and stand in solidarity and uplifting those who are living a reality of the theology of the cross in their daily lives. So yes, we come to that. And that is why I wanted you to share a little bit more about theology of the cross as you see it, as you live it in your own lives. We can start with what you were just reading in the book about you were very much inspired by St. Francis, I understand.
And what?
That you were very much inspired by St. Francis.
Oh, I was a friend of mine who worked here for a couple weeks lent me the book because he thought I would really enjoy it. But I was really inspired by St. Francis. I really liked that he was, his idea of living among people and living among nature, that the church shouldn't be separate from these social issues, from these environmental issues, but in the middle of it, I really appreciated that quite a bit.
Which, of course, if you go back to the theology of the cross, says things as they are, he wasn't very popular. And if you embrace that, you know, there are, and he wasn't in his days, he has, you know, afterwards, but that there is real power in that prophetic attitude.
I go to a Catholic Lutheran church, mm-hmm. and one of our priests was a Franciscan priest, mm-hmm. and he always would tell us that when he made the sign of the cross at the end of the service, to remember that it goes up and down and across. Mm-hmm. And we can never be in relation to God if we are not in relation with the world and the people.
The cross is a scandal. Honestly, why would any religion use an instrument of torture as its main symbol? That in and of itself, I mean, Luther talked about paradox, that's just simply crazy.
Does that come from the time during the Roman rule with the crucifixion? I mean, that's where that comes from, correct?
Well, of course, it goes back to the very act of Jesus being crucified. Number one, that we embrace this as a symbol, but not even that Jesus was unique, because he was not the only one crucified, you know? And that is supposed to have believers think very seriously about this. So much so that in the early church, during Lent, when people were preparing to enter church to be baptized, that Lent is a time in which we talk about God dying. So you are wedding, you are baptizing Easter, and you're baptizing the church in which God dies. That's crazy, you know? But then there is resurrection. And only when you are aware of this deep void, the darkness of the night, is when you can appreciate light. If you always have light, you know, then it's difficult to acknowledge the beauty of that. But the cross is an instrument of torture, that we use that as our symbol. I don't think we have reflected sufficiently. And the cross, on the one hand, it has that horizontal and vertical dimension, because it's supposed to relate humanity with the divine. It also relates us with one another. But the cross is also a crossing. It's a crossing over. It's a constant crossing over, that I move away from myself. I cross over to you. God crosses over to me. And that constant breaking away from, you know, crossing borders is happening. The traditional Lutheran way of explaining it, he uses the expression incubatus in se, you know, the word belly gazing, is what theologians usually, because, you know, honestly, that's part of our simple reality. We think that our belly buttons are the most beautiful. and we do this, you know. And what the cross does, the theology of the cross, the crossing over, is that we move away from, and we can be uplifted. And something else happens, you know, as we move over, you know, we can also reach out and see our bodies then become living crosses, because then we can cross over to other people as well. Thank you for bringing this imagery. Okay, I spoke too much. More about yourself. Yes, please.
Mark. I'm really pleased. I'm in ministry in Salt Lake City, Utah, and there aren't many crosses there with a predominant culture. And as I reflect, I'm rather pleased that the way that we witness has everything, the crux of our faith, pun intended. We have to talk about the cross.
Thinking about number 18 and rephrasing it a different way. It says it is certain that people must utterly despair of their own ability before they are prepared to receive the grace of Christ. And if you have a problem with a sin in your life, you must first call it a sin before you can move on to grace. If you don't want to call it a sin for some reason because you're uncomfortable with calling something a sin, you're never going to move on. I had a friend I was helping. She and I had the same problem, but she was mentally ill and she had a ton of strain. The problem was to start in your mind thinking of a story of something bad happening to you. I used to have a problem when I would drive by this one street on my way home. There was the road and then there was the lake. I used to have these things about driving into the lake. Every time I went past it, I hated driving past it. In Psalms, there's a verse that says, search me, O God, and see if in me there's any way of pain. and otherwise translated a wicked way, it's really a sin. But I think a way of pain is a very good way to put it, because that was a way of pain. It was a torment to me. And she had this to a much greater degree. It was a huge torment in her life. And I told her, I said, Marie, what you need to do first with this is say, first you say, Lord, this is a sin. When you catch yourself doing it, you know, you get in the line and you're in the lake and then you're into the water and how are you going to get out of the car? You say, wait a minute, Lord, this is a sin. I confess it is sin. Then immediately you grab on with grace. And Paul said, I bring all my thoughts captive to Christ. And so the next thing I would say is, Lord, I bring these thoughts captive to you. And then I was out of it. I've had this all my life that I can remember, and sometimes it'd be a big problem, and then less. You know, it would go in waves. I have to say that now I'm relatively free of it. But the thing that freed me was to call it, to be willing to say that this is a sin, because then I could get to the grace. Otherwise, I was stuck.
I would normally ask people to show the crosses that they carry. Do you have any cross with you? Can you very briefly tell us about the crosses that you carry?
Mine is a mother of pearls cross, and I carry it. I know that you said, I thought about what you said as a symbol. I'm not Lutheran at all, and I have a faith background. I'm Pentecostal, and I just happened to come because I heard about the theology of the cross, and I'm just very curious. But I very seriously do know that this is a symbol of what happened, but I always carry it to remind me. I always remind myself of what side of the cross I'm on. The side of that when Jesus was crucified, or the resurrection side. And I always remind myself that I'm on the resurrection side. The side that Jesus was rose again. That's the side that I was on. That my sins are forgiven.
Beautiful. Thank you. Well, I actually have two. Here's that one. It's very simple. I wanted it very simple and plain because I wanted to remember it was, you know, it's not something. It was a hard cross that Christ died. And I carry it and I just hold it because in our dark nights of the soul, it reminds me that Christ is with me. And now this one that I just bought from Walmart, because I carry it to remind me that Christ is with me in the dark night of my soul, and that Christ brings that ray of light that Jonathan and Renee saw in Deb to light, that God is bringing me life every day and light. And so
I got one on my hat. It's Serving on Christ's Team. A book is written by that title by Dr. Bob Frank, who's a physicist at Augustana College, retired. And it's great to know that science and religion can work together.
Beautiful.
And,
we have to talk.
I also have one on my key chain because I have driven 2,020 miles to get over here, and I'm a male, and I'm also Norwegian, and I don't like to admit that I'm not God. I get tired. And like you were saying, if I don't recognize it, I'll just go right off the road. I have to remember and know that this is, I got people with me, I'm tired, I got to stop and rest. So I take the cross with me, you know, I need to be renewed. I like that. You talk about all the time.
To finish up, in the Passion narrative, in the crucifixion, when Jesus is at the cross, and at the foot of the cross are his mother, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Cleophas, and the beloved disciple, and they're weeping.
And for me, that is a symbol for what the theology of the cross is all about. It is compassion, it is suffering with, and yet at that very moment, resurrection always also begins. Resurrection begins when the community can gather and cry together and then have hope for resurrection that will happen on the third day. Mm-hmm. With that thought, thank you so much for your attention and for the hard work that you're putting in.